2 Corinthians chapter 6 and this morning we're coming to verse 11. I should warn you that we're not going to come to verse 11 immediately. In fact, we're only going to start looking at that verse towards the end of our time this morning. What I want us to do first is to take an overview of the letter as we've looked at it so far. I want to remind you why Paul had to write this letter, because that will cast light on the verses we're going to be looking at next. Basically, the reason why Paul wrote this letter was that he was trying to rebuild his relationship with the church in Corinth. Things had gone badly wrong between Paul and that church. It was Paul who founded the church in Corinth. Paul was there guiding it for the first couple of years. But then Paul moved on and other people took over the leadership of the church. Paul carried on trying to help and guide the church from a distance. You read the first letter to the Corinthians and you'll see some of the issues that Paul had to deal with from a distance. And Paul had to be very sharp and clear about some issues where people in the church were behaving badly. And it's clear that there were some people in the church who didn't like what Paul was saying to them. So tensions grew up between Paul and the Corinthian Christians. And when finally Paul went back and visited the church, the whole situation exploded. From what we've read, it seems that there was somebody in that church who really had a go at Paul, who abused him, attacked him, behaved in a really wicked way towards Paul. And the other members of the church stood back and let that happen. So Paul left Corinth heartbroken and humiliated. He had been planning to go back and make a second visit to the church, but he had to cancel that visit because he felt it could only do harm if he went back there as things stood. What Paul did instead of returning was that he sent his friend and assistant Titus to the church. And he gave Titus a letter to read out to the members of the church. And in that letter, Paul spelled out how shocked and horrified he was by their behavior. And he made it clear that they simply had to expel the man who had led the attack on him. Paul sends off the letter with Titus, and then he waits. He waits for Titus to return and to tell him how the church has reacted. It took longer than expected for Paul and Titus to meet up again, and for Titus to give Paul his report. But when he did, the news on the whole was very encouraging. The church, when they heard Paul's letter and heard what Titus had to say, the church was really shocked. The church was very distressed by the tone of what Paul had written. They were sorry for the way they'd behaved. And they did exactly what he said. They expelled the troublemaker from the church. When we come to chapter 7 of this letter, you'll see there just how upset the Corinthian Christians were when they realized how badly they treated Paul. It's in chapter 7, verse 11. See what earnestness this godly grief has produced in you, but also what eagerness to clear yourselves. What indignation, what fear, what longing, what zeal, what punishment. They were really distressed, and they really punished the wrongdoer. So far, so good. Paul was hugely encouraged when he heard from Titus what their response had been. And Paul was more than ready to forgive the way that they treated him. And yet, Paul knew that there was still a problem. Yes, these Corinthian Christians were really shocked, sorry, ashamed, because they knew they treated Paul badly. And yes, they'd done what Paul had told them to do. They'd expelled the man who had led the attack on him. But Paul still knew that their fundamental outlook hadn't really changed at all. Why had they cooled off towards Paul in the first place? Why had they resented it so much when he pointed out things that needed changing in the church? Why had they been so ready to back the man who attacked him? The fact was that though they were feeling ashamed of themselves now, they still had a fundamental attitude problem in relation to Paul. I guess most parents here will know just what I mean. You know what I mean when I talk about a child with an attitude problem. He or she thinks that mum and dad know nothing. He or she resents everything they say. He or she gets angry if mum tells him that he can't do X or Y. He makes it clear that he simply has no respect for mum and dad. Well, one day there's a big row, and this youngster starts shouting. Maybe he actually hits mum in his frustration. Or maybe he starts swearing at dad. And afterwards, he feels really ashamed. He knows he's overstepped the mark. And he says sorry. And mum or dad accept his apologies. They give him a big hug. But if they're realistic, they know that the problem's not been solved. Yes, he's sorry about that particular episode. He knows he went too far. But that doesn't mean that his fundamental outlook has changed. He's still a lad with an attitude problem. Well, that's the way it was with the Corinthians and Paul. We're not talking about every member of the church, of course. I'm sure that there were happy exceptions. But viewed as a whole, the church still had an attitude problem towards Paul. What Paul's doing in this letter is he's trying to diagnose that attitude problem, trying to see what it springs from, and then to remedy it. The big crisis had been diffused for the moment, but the underlying problem was still there, and it needed addressing. Now, what was the problem? Why were the Corinthian Christians so reluctant to accept Paul's authority? Why were they so quick to take offence at him? Why were they so eager to sideline him? Well, we've seen the answer to that question as we've worked through the letter. The answer's this. They had been conditioned by the culture they lived in to think that the people who really matter, the only people you should really respect, are big people. People with big reputations and big egos. People who talk big and act big. People who come over with as glamorous and charismatic and successful. people who have got the right image, people who are prosperous, people who are forceful, people who insist on having their own way. The Corinthian Christians had learned from their society that those were the sort of people you ought to listen to. And the problem that they had with Paul was that he didn't fit that profile. And he wasn't prepared to try. He wasn't rich. He wasn't glamorous. He came over as emotionally vulnerable. He was poor. He was often ill. He admitted there were lots of things he couldn't cope with. He admitted he'd failed to carry through lots of his plans. He was in and out of prison. He looked half dead a lot of the time. And the Corinthian Christians found him a bit embarrassing, frankly. They didn't want to be linked with somebody who came over as weak as Paul did. They were looking for leaders with a very different persona. Paul puts his finger on it in chapter 12 when he says, "You bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face." And then sarcastically he adds, "But to my shame, I must say, we were too weak for that." It's just like the teenage lad or girl I was just describing. She's got no respect for her parents because they've got the wrong image. They're not cool. They're not fashionable. They live a boring, respectable, law-abiding life. She doesn't want to listen to their advice or to obey their commands. The fact that they actually care about her and that they put up with all her tantrums, that only makes her despise them more. But if some cool gang leader, think Rotherham if you like, comes along and pushes her around and makes demands on her and acts as if he's got the right to make her do anything he wants, however humiliating, she's ready to subject herself to everything he demands, however unreasonable, however cruel. You see it with some youngsters when they go away to university or college. They lose all respect for their parents, because their parents are old-fashioned and boring, and they've got no experience of life. They've been doing the same jobs for 20 years. But they hang on the words of some incredible, fantastic, amazing, awesome lecturer in his late 20s who knows everything about everything. And who actually knows people who have worked for the BBC? Every word he says is infallible. They want to walk like him and talk like him, and if he told them to jump off the Eiffel Tower, they'd do it. Well, that was the Corinthian Christians. They couldn't respect Paul, who had given his life to serving them. But they could respect the cool guys who had just turned up and who treated them like dirt. And those guys were there on the spot. Paul talks about them as the super apostles. The cool, fashionable, boastful, big leaders who expected the Corinthian Christians to treat them like gods. And the Corinthian Christians did. They wouldn't listen to Paul, the apostle Jesus Christ himself had appointed. But they'd listen to the superstar apostles who'd been appointed by no one but themselves. So do you understand what Paul was trying to combat when he wrote this letter? He is really alarmed by the way these Corinthian Christians think about him. And the reasons why they think about him the way they do. It really frightens him when he sees Christians who have bought into the world's idea of what makes a man successful and worth following. Yeah, of course it hurts him personally when the Corinthian Christians show how little they think of him. But that's not the most important thing, is it? It's the fact that they've got this ingrained view of what really counts. And they think that what really counts is to be a success story. Big, fashionable, high-achieving, good-looking, glamorous. That's what really bothers him. Again, think of it in terms of our teenager looking down on his parents, looking up to the fashionable role models that he's chosen for himself. His parents, yeah, they're upset that he can't speak to them without a sneer in his voice. But it's not just personal pride that makes them upset. Even if they weren't his parents, they'd think his attitude is ugly and wrong. They're distressed because they think his outlook is shameful. And more than that, they can see that he's vulnerable, that he's likely to finish up getting exploited and hurt by the people he admires so much for the wrong reasons. So Paul is alarmed for all these reasons. But there was an even bigger reason why Paul was alarmed, why he was horrified by their outlook. And it was simply this. The way they were thinking was a denial of the whole Christian gospel. What is the central fact round which the whole Christian message is built? It's this: God's Son died on a cross. God's Son lived most of his life here in this world in obscurity. He lived all of it in poverty. He worked as a carpenter in a peasant village. He became a homeless wanderer. He was rejected by all the fashionable people. He was condemned as a criminal. He was betrayed by one of his followers. He was abandoned by all the rest of his followers. And finally, he was stripped naked. He was tortured to death on a cross. He was often desperately lonely. He went hungry and thirsty. He cried when one of his few real friends died. He was overwhelmed with fear and distress as he saw his death approaching. When he was hanging on a cross, he cried out that his Father had abandoned him. Paul sums it up in a single phrase in the last chapter of his letter when he says, "Christ was crucified in weakness." When people looked at Jesus hanging on the cross, they saw someone who looked weak, helpless, ridiculous, a total failure. Jesus was not fashionable. He was not glamorous. He was not rich. He had no qualifications. There was no record of success. His life was a life of suffering. His death was a death of torture and shame. But Jesus was willing to live that life because it was what God his Father wanted. He was willing to accept that death because it was what God his Father had planned. And by living that life and dying that death, Jesus rescued countless people from everlasting misery and ruin. He broke the hold that sin and death had on us. He bought everlasting life for us. He cancelled out the curse that lay on the whole universe. He won the greatest victory that's ever been won. He's our hero. He's our champion. He's our king. He's the man to whom we've entrusted our souls. He's the man we've sworn to follow. But here in this world he lived his life like a slave and he died the death of a criminal. We've placed all our hope on a naked, battered, rejected, helpless man who hung on a cross. We believe that he alone is worthy to be loved and served forever. So, Christians can never buy into the idea that the people we should look up to are the successful people, the rich people, the powerful people, the people who boast about their strength and their achievements. Jesus wasn't one of those people. And yet we say, Jesus is worthy that every knee should bow to him and that every tongue should confess that he is Lord. And likewise, Christians can never think that a life of suffering and helplessness is something to be despised. The Corinthian Christians were looking at Paul and they were seeing how weak he was, how many disasters and troubles he'd had to go through. They could see how physically wrecked, how emotionally vulnerable he was. They could see that he was penniless and persecuted, and they despised him for these things. But those things were only happening to Paul because he was joined to Jesus Christ. Christ's sufferings were overflowing into his life. So how could they say, oh, we honour Christ because he was willing to suffer for us, and then in their hearts look down on Paul when he was suffering with Christ? Do you see what I mean when I say that their attitude was a denial of the whole gospel? The moment Christians start talking and acting as if what we need are glamorous, dynamic leaders, people with an aura of success and power, that moment we're denying that Jesus is the Lord and that Jesus' death on the cross is God's way to save the world. When they look down on Paul, and when they looked up to the super apostles, the Corinthian Christians were denying Christ himself. They didn't realize it, but that's what they were doing. And that's what Paul has to make them aware of. In the end, Paul is, all the way through this letter, he's fighting for the Corinthian Christians to choose him in his weakness, not the super apostles in their apparent strength. But the reason why he's got to do that is that he wants them to choose Christ in his weakness. He wants their great role model, their great hero, to be the man who was willing to work like a slave, the man who was willing to suffer, the man who was obedient unto death. And they're being distracted from that Jesus because they've got this picture in their heads of incredible, fantastic, powerful, super Christians who never fail at anything and who never struggle and who are never afraid and who never run out of energy and who never look stupid and never get laughed at. They're forgetting Jesus. You know, if there's one great positive lesson which comes out of this second letter to the Corinthians, it's the fact that every single believer and every single church has to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, the real man who lived here in this world and who died on the cross. We've got to keep thinking about the sort of life he lived and the sort of death he died. Because that's the life we're called to live. And that's the death we're called to die. Not just once, but over and over again. If you've been here over past weeks, you'll know what I mean by that. We've got to be coming back to the Gospels again and again, so that we can look at Jesus again. Because it's when you look at Jesus you see what the Christian life is supposed to be like. You see where obedience to God actually takes you. Look at Jesus. He's wandering in the desert. And he's desperately hungry. No, he's starving. And terrible, horrible thoughts are invading his mind and he can't block them out. He seems to be standing on the pinnacle of the temple. He's actually in the desert. But in his mind he's standing there, high above the world. And he's being tempted to throw himself off. And that thought is pounding away in his brain. Do it, go on. And verses from the Old Testament are going round and round in his head, telling him he can do it. And that God's angels will protect him. That's how close Jesus is to complete breakdown. That's where obeying God can lead you, to a point of utter bewilderment and confusion and desperation and dreadful, dreadful temptation. Look at Jesus. He's teaching a huge crowd, more than 5,000 people. And then after spending hours teaching them, he has to provide them all with food and he has to dispense it all from his own hands. He's been on his feet for hours. He's exhausted. And the crowd won't leave him alone. In fact, they want to make him king. And he tries to get away from them. But they follow him. And they start questioning him. And he can't send them away again. Instead, he has to start teaching them once more. And they don't like what he says to them. They think it's offensive. They think it's disgusting. And they begin to drift away from him. And the crowd begins to thin. And finally he looks round and they've all gone. All this work, all these hours of teaching, all the energy he's expended, and there's nothing to show for it. By any human standard, he's failed. These people came to listen to him and he's lost them all. And he turns, he's shaken, he's discouraged. He turns to his 12 disciples and says, are you going to leave me too? And they all say, no, we're going to stick with you, come what may. And they are going to for a little while, but he knows that the day will come when they will leave him as well. And when he'll be completely alone, that's where obedience to God's ways leads him. That's where obedience to God's ways can lead us. To what looks like complete failure and discouragement and loneliness. He's lying on the ground in a garden. And he's pleading with God to avert a horrible, horrible experience that he can see a little way ahead. He's saying the same thing over and over again to his Father. Please, if it's possible, please take this cup from me. And the sweat is pouring off him. It's like great drops of blood. He's in agony of mind as he prays. His body is convulsed. And then he hears the soldiers approaching who are going to arrest him, led by the traitor Judas. And he knows that his Father has said no to what he's prayed for. He knows he's going to have to drink the cup to the bottom. He's going to have to go through the worst, the most terrifying experience in the world. That's where obedience to God can lead you. To hearing God say no to your most desperate prayers. He's hanging on the cross. And people are laughing and sniggering. He's supposed to be the Son of God, isn't he? Well, if God wants him, let God come and rescue him. And God doesn't. God lets his Son hang there, being mocked and made a fool of by everyone. And that's where obedience to God can lead you, to being called a lunatic, a blasphemer, a deluded fool. And God stands back and lets it happen. Now it's this Jesus who's our hero. It's this Jesus who won the victory over sin and death. It's this Jesus who's now sitting on the throne of the universe in glory. It's this Jesus who's now experiencing a joy that makes everything he went through infinitely worthwhile. But this was Jesus' life here in this world. It was a life of frustration and pain and defeat and humiliation, but it's the life that leads to glory. What the Corinthian Christians needed, what Christians in every generation need, is to be keeping their eyes set on the real Jesus. Remembering the life he lived here in this world, remembering the death he died. If they do that, they won't be taken in by the lies that the super apostles are selling. And they won't be tempted to despise Paul, who was experiencing in his own life a little bit of what Jesus experienced here in this world. I've said that these Corinthian Christians were like youngsters who had been brainwashed by the society around them. They'd been brainwashed into despising their own parents and admiring more fashionable role models. Well, Paul's trying to help them to escape from that conditioning. He thinks of these Corinthian Christians as his children. After all, he led them to Christ. Well, he wants them now to leave behind the world's thinking and to come back to enjoy a happy, respectful relationship with him again. It'll only happen if they give Christ, the real Jesus, his proper place again. But that's what he's after. Paul's wanting to re-establish the relationship that there ought to be between him as their father and the Corinthians as his children in the Lord. There's been this barrier between him. There's been this barrier between him and them. It's happened because of their attitude problem. Well, now he wants them to recognize that. He wants the barrier to be taken down. That's what he's pleading for in chapter 6, verses 11 to 13. See, we did get there in the end. This is what Paul says. We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide open. You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children. Widen your hearts also. You see the key phrase there, don't you? It's almost at the end. I speak as to children. This is Paul as a father, pleading with his children. Yes, they're on speaking terms, just. But there's not the relationship there should be. And the reason why is that they have this cold, contemptuous, dismissive attitude towards him. Well, all the way through the letter, Paul's been showing them how wrong their thinking is. But now Paul's making the direct appeal. Look, he says, I'm being honest with you. We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians. I can't pretend I don't know what you think of me and the people who work with me. And I can't pretend that it doesn't matter. I spelled it out, what the problem is. The problem is you. The problem is your attitude. We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart, he says, is wide open. If there's a rift between us, he says, and there is, it's not on our side. We're not keeping you at a distance. You're keeping us at a distance. Our heart is open to you. You're not restricted by us, he says. We're not squeezing you out. We're not closing our hearts to you. No, it's you who are restricted in your own affections. It's you who have squeezed us out. It's you who have withdrawn into your own selves and blocked off the affection you should have. Paul's big point is we love you still. So in return, he says, since I love you, and it's my children I'm speaking to, widen your hearts also. Open your hearts to us. This is exactly the language, isn't it, of countless parents who feel that they're in a standoff with their children. They want to love and protect their children. They want to open their arms and hug their children. But it's the children who put up this cold, defensive wall. They want no more to do with mum and dad than is absolutely necessary. They tolerate their parents, but they can't show any affection for them. Secretly, they're ashamed or at least embarrassed by their parents. Well, that's how Paul feels the Corinthians are with him. And he spent 5.5 chapters trying to break down that attitude, trying to show them that they've got no reason to be ashamed of him, showing them that all the things they find so embarrassing about him are simply the marks that he's God's servant. He's been showing them that his values are Christ's values. He's been showing them that if they want to have Christ as their Lord and Saviour, they have to accept the same values that Paul is living by. He's done all this groundwork. He's tried to break down their prejudices. He's tried to undo the brainwashing that they've received. But now's the moment when it all spills out in direct appeal. Oh, my children, says Paul, please understand, I love you. And I want you to love me as I am. My heart's open to you. Can't you open your hearts to me? Paul really loves these people as a father loves his children. He wants to have a happy, open, joyful, trusting relationship with them. But they're the ones who have got to change. It's going to be costly for them to change. That's what comes over in the verses that follow, verses 14 to 18. Like we keep saying, they've been brainwashed by the society they live in. They're living in a society which despises people like Paul. People who are poor and who struggle and who don't wear fashionable clothes and who don't talk in the right way and who don't have the right connections. And these believers have bought into all that. They've got their friends and their colleagues who think and talk like that. And it's all rubbed off on them. The reason why they've been cold towards Paul is because they share the values of the unbelievers. Well, Paul says in verse 14, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. You understand the picture? We've got a yoke, a wooden structure like a sort of big collar that's put round the neck of two animals so that together they can pull a cart or a plough. Well, it's not going to work, is it? Unless you've got two animals who are roughly the same size and the same strength and who move at the same pace. You couldn't yoke together, say, an ox and a donkey. Well, these believers in Corinth were trying to live yoked together with unbelievers. They were supposed to be completely different from unbelievers in their lifestyles and in their priorities and in their role models and in their values, but they'd linked themselves up to unbelievers and were trying to keep step with them. The unbelievers despised somebody like Paul. The unbelievers thought Paul was a nobody who counted for nothing. And these believers were going along with them. Paul's saying to his children in Corinth, don't let unbelievers dictate to you who you should admire, who you should associate with. Be prepared to be different from them, to think and talk and act differently from them. Don't let yourself be dragged along by them as if there was a yoke binding you together. Do you see the two challenges, how they go together? On the one side, Paul's saying to his children, I want you to stop putting up barriers between us. I want to have a happy, trusting, open relationship in which you're glad to be with me and I'm glad to be with you. But then he adds, yes, and that will mean putting a distance between yourselves and your unbelieving friends. Because they don't like me, and they don't like my values, and they don't like my master, the Lord Jesus. Verse 15, what accord has Christ with Belial? Paul says, I serve Christ, they serve Satan. In the end, the Corinthians have to choose. Do they want to be accepted by their fashionable friends, or do they want to be close to Paul, the man who was their spiritual father? Do they want to follow Paul's master, or do they want to worship the gods of this world? In one sense, they'd made that choice already when they were converted, if they were ever truly converted. When they were baptized, they said that they would worship and serve Christ crucified. They'd said that Jesus alone was Lord, but it's obvious that as time had gone by, they'd forgotten the choice they'd made then. So now, as they read this letter, they have to make that choice all over again. And then they have to make it again every day of their life. And so do we. It would be lovely if it were a choice you could make once and for all. But it's really not. Every day of your life, there will be the same question. Am I willing to take up my cross and follow Christ? Am I willing to break with the values and the priorities of the world in order to follow Christ crucified? It's the decision we make each day and every day.